From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton says the balanced budget amendment failed because Senate Republicans could not guarantee that Social Security would be protected. And he said it's now up to the Republicans to produce a budget as they've promised. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The president spoke to reporters shortly after the Senate failed by one vote to muster the two-thirds majority needed to send the balanced budget amendment out to the states. He called on Republican supporters of the balanced budget amendment to produce their own spending plan. The president said after 8 weeks in power, the GOP has yet to present a budget.
I am as ready as ever to work with the Congress to make further reductions in the deficit. As I have said repeatedly, it must come in the context of responsible health care reform, because it is only the health care costs of the country that are going up in our budget.
Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole has vowed to bring the balanced budget amendment up again next year when re-election pressures are stronger. I'm Peter Kenyon in Washington.
The House Appropriations Committee voted today to cut federal spending by $17 billion this year. And the programs that would be slashed included summer jobs for young people, nutrition programs, and housing subsidies. The measure contains an amendment that would give states the right to deny Medicaid funding for abortions for poor women who are victims of rape or incest. It would provide almost $5.5 billion for disaster relief for California and other states. The committee turned back three Democratic attempts to restore some of the cuts. The UN mission in Somalia is over. American Marines have left the beaches of Mogadishu after they guarded the pullout of the last remaining UN peacekeepers. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
From a military standpoint, the UN pullout went without a hitch. No foreign troops were hurt, no equipment lost, and during 3 days ashore, U.S. and Italian Marines rarely felt threatened enough to shoot at Somalis. But the international experience over the last 2 years in Somalia has left scars. 44 Americans lost their lives, along with dozens of peacekeepers from other nations and hundreds of Somalis, in a mission that tried to forge a new peacemaking role for the UN. And though huge amounts of money flowed into the country to kickstart farming, schools, hospitals, and businesses, all the aid and the accomplishments will mean little if Somalia returns to clan warfare now that foreign troops are gone. This is Michael Scholar reporting.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street as the dollar fell to a new post-war low against the Japanese yen. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 15 points to close at 3,980. Declining issues led advances by a 4-3 margin in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 329 million shares. Prices were lower on the NASDAQ. This is NPR. Former Italian Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti has been ordered to stand trial in Sicily on charges that he was a member of the mafia. The 76-year-old former premier is accused of using his influence to get lenient treatment in the courts for mafia members. Maryland may soon have the toughest anti-smoking rules in the nation. Democratic Governor Paris Glendinning has endorsed regulations that forbid smoking at all indoor workplaces, including restaurants, bars, airport lobbies, and convention halls. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
Governor Glendinning says the ban will protect Maryland workers from the dangers of tobacco smoke. He says smoking is responsible for 1/5 of all deaths in Maryland each year, and smoking-related illnesses cost the state $1.2 billion. But business groups charge the ban will devastate hotels, taverns, and nightclubs. The democratically controlled state legislature is hearing these complaints and may create an exception for places where alcohol is served. Mike Miller is president of the Maryland Senate.
By putting these rules and regulations in place, it's sending a wrong message in terms of economic development, in terms of encouraging business to locate in Maryland. I think the legislature is going to have some say in this before we adjourn in April.
But the governor says he'll oppose any bill that, in his words, compromises the integrity of the ban. Meanwhile, business interests have filed a lawsuit against the regulations. This is Laura Kanoy reporting.
The man accused of bringing down Britain's oldest investment bank was arrested today in Germany. German police are holding Nick Leeson, the 28-year-old trader whose gambles in Japanese futures led to an estimated $1 billion loss for Barings Bank. Leeson told German police that he wants to return to Britain, but he's being held pending an extradition request and arrest warrant from the British authorities. Barings collapsed after the firm's accountants went to Singapore and discovered the extent of Leeson's transactions there. This is NPR News.
Here is an opinion piece by Jim Lewis, Senior Vice President for Development at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
I've been listening to the case for privatizing everything from public broadcasting to the VPA, and I'm beginning to see the wisdom of it. But why start with public broadcasting, which already raises most of its own funds? Let's start with something that takes more than twice the federal subsidy and doesn't even try to pay its own way. Let's privatize Congress. Each congressional candidate should seek sponsorship from a corporation willing to pay his campaign costs and, if elected, his salary and office expenses. These relationships should be public, no more hiding them until after Election Day. Let voters study both the candidates and their sponsors and cast their ballots accordingly. Would corporations respond to this challenge? Several business leaders say they're eager to buy members of Congress. They foresee not only legislative benefits, but commercial tie-ins as their lawmakers appear on newscasts and interview programs dressed in T-shirts, sweatshirts, and baseball caps adorned with corporate logos. Sponsoring members of Congress is just a start. We can do more. If you watched the State of the Union message, as I did, you may have noticed the amount of empty space in the House chamber. Let's fill it up. Subsidizing the cost of House operations with messages from Pepsi, Budweiser, and Copenhagen Snuff. The Senate has room for a couple of giant billboards. Finally, the American people deserve a fair share of the many ancillary products produced by Congress. 23 senators have books in print. Where's our cut? These guys are full-time employees. Let's get real. Just because the legislature is a branch of government doesn't mean it shouldn't be run in a business-like manner. Privatizing Congress will get it off the backs of American taxpayers and make those who benefit foot the bill.
This has been an opinion piece by Jim Lewis, Senior Vice President for Development at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Noah Adams. The balanced budget amendment was defeated today in the U.S. Senate. Its supporters came up just one vote short, but they vow that the issue is not dead. After days of bargaining and buying time, supporters still didn't have the 67 votes needed to send the constitutional amendment on to the states for ratification.
The defeat was a blow to the Republican majority, which had framed the issue as a vote for fiscal responsibility. But Democrats centered their opposition on protection of Social Security, also an extremely popular issue. And in the end, Majority Leader Bob Dole switched his vote to a no, so that under Senate rules he could bring the amendment up again. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Republicans trudged to the floor this afternoon knowing they didn't have the votes to pass the amendment. But Democrats also trudged to the floor knowing they would win but uncertain as to whether they should celebrate. In the last few days, the focus has been more on the political consequences of a vote for or against the amendment than on the merits of the amendment itself. In his speech shortly before the vote, Senator Dole characterized the whole debate as an issue of states' rights. Although the idea of the balanced budget amendment came from Congress, Dole now says it's being held hostage by Congress and should be passed so that it will be up to the states to ratify.
I'm willing to trust the American people to make the right decision. Those who oppose the amendment or not, that's what this debate's all about. Returning power to the people, returning power to the states. That's what the American people say they want. They want to make decisions. We're not going to give them that opportunity. We're going to take that away from them if we don't adopt this amendment. And what we're saying, in effect, if the amendment fails, well, Washington knows best. This business as usual. We know what you want. Don't tell us you know what you want, because we know better.
The amendment is overwhelmingly popular. It was the centerpiece of many campaigns last November. It's favored by almost 80% of the American people in most polls. But that number drops quickly to almost 30% when those same people are asked if they would still favor it if it would require cuts in Social Security. So that's where opponents put their focus, raising the fears of a powerful constituency, the elderly. Supporters of the amendment labeled the Social Security argument as phony, but at the same time they were unwilling to specifically protect it, no matter how many votes it would win over. As the amendment came to a vote, Democrats changed their tone as well, saying it's now time to get on with the actual job of balancing the budget. Minority Leader Tom Daschle said Democrats had already begun the process.
We're prepared to continue that commitment for as long as it takes to put this debt behind us for good. So no one should be misled about the political rhetoric about our position. We will do what we have already done. We will work to bring down the debt with or without a constitutional amendment.
President Clinton echoed Daschle from the White House when the amendment failed, saying it's now time for Republicans to lay out how they intend to balance the budget. But Republicans were still focused on the failed amendment. Senator Dole and a dozen smiling Republican senators held a press conference immediately after the vote.
The American people have lost today. The American people have lost. But I can promise them, as my colleagues can standing with me, that there'll be other opportunities. As you know, I did change my vote, file a motion to reconsider. We can call that up at any time. Any time one senator said, I've changed my mind. Any time one senator said, well, maybe the little change in conference, I could be persuaded. Any time the election heat is turned up enough that they begin to understand how important this is to the American people, we'll bring it back up.
Democrats who voted with Republicans in support of the amendment weren't as upbeat. Illinois Senator Paul Simon, a co-sponsor of the amendment, isn't worried about politics. He's retiring. But he says he's worried about the deficit.
I think it is a sad day for this country. I think it means we're having a tough time breaking our debt addiction. And the longer you keep an addiction, the tougher it is to break it.
Democrat Hal Heflin, also a supporter of the amendment, challenged the rhetoric on both sides of the issue, saying the amendment should be amended and brought back up.
The issue is, what do we do now? And it gets down to me to be quite simple. The Republicans say they want to protect Social Security. The Democrats want to protect Social Security. Well, why not put it in?
That's the question of the week, and both sides know the answer. If the Social Security surplus is kept out of the equation, balancing the budget by the year 2002 is next to impossible. But as long as Senator Dole continues to bring up the amendment, its opponents say they'll continue to bring up Social Security. Senator Daschle promised as much today.
I welcome. He can put that amendment down every month if he wants to. He can put it down next September. He can put it down the day before the election. If that's his choice, we're ready for it. The fact is that we believe that the American people share our view that you don't reduce the deficit by using Social Security trust funds.
These arguments are likely to be repeated this year on the Senate floor. Amending the Constitution to balance the budget has been debated for decades. So far this year, it's occupied more of the Senate's time than actually trying to balance the budget. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Had the Senate passed the balanced budget amendment, it would now be on its way to the states. Three-fourths of all state legislatures need to approve any amendment before it can be added to the Constitution. Several states, eager to be the first to ratify the amendment, had already begun work on doing that. Today, legislators in those states expressed frustration over the inability of Congress to pass the amendment, but other state officials, who were worried that a balanced federal budget could mean deep cuts in state programs, expressed relief. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
Lawmakers in all 50 states have been watching the debate in Washington closely. Many were excited about the prospect of casting a vote in favor of what could have been the 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. In Michigan, Republican State Senator Joanne Emmons has been pushing for the federal government to balance its budget for years. She reacted this way when it became clear that the U.S. Senate would fall short of approving the amendment.
I'm very disappointed that they are not going to pass the balanced budget amendment. We have worked under one in Michigan, and it keeps you from doing spending that you really don't need to do. And it's the size of the debt that national government has created that is just, people are just furious.
Michigan is one of several states where Republicans control both legislative chambers and where steps to approve the balanced budget amendment had already gotten underway, even before the U.S. Senate had concluded debate on the measure. For opponents of the proposal, there was relief today after the Senate vote. In Indiana, Governor Evan Bayh, a Democrat, says he supports the idea of a balanced federal budget, but says he had concerns about what the amendment would have meant for his state's finances.
If they cut spending at the federal level to get their budget balanced, just like states have to do, then that's a good thing. But having observed Washington politicians for a long time now, I hope you'll forgive me for being a little skeptical. And when faced with a lot of these difficult decisions, I'm afraid what they're going to do is just pile a lot of them on state and local taxpayers, which will mean lower education funding or higher state and local taxes, and that would not be a good thing for states like Indiana.
Despite Governor By's reservations, both houses of the Indiana legislature are Republican-controlled and were expected to vote to ratify the amendment by a wide margin. Still, ratification by the states was by no means a foregone conclusion. Analyst Stephen Gold of the New York-based Center for the Study of the State said that over time, as lawmakers added up the potential impact on their state's budget, many would be reluctant to vote yes. And remember, if 13 states say no, then that's it. Gold gave the amendment no better than a 50-50 chance of getting approval in the necessary 38 states within the 7-year time limit.
If it had passed, there would have been many states ratifying it right away, but ratification by 3/4 of the states was certainly not a sure thing.
Gold brings up the relatively recent example of the proposed Equal Rights Amendment, which in the 1970s started out strong with widespread public support, but which eventually fell short of the states needed for approval. On the balanced budget amendment, Gold says moves made by Republicans in Washington to keep the proposal on the table for consideration later on in the 104th Congress keeps the issue alive for states as well. He adds that as states try to make budget and revenue projections for the future, they'll come up against a huge question mark when trying to calculate how much money they can count on from the federal government. He also says expect opponents of the amendment to work hard to sway public opinion by demonstrating just what kind of cuts to state programs deep federal cuts could mean. Meanwhile, balanced budget amendment supporters on the state level are vowing to punish senators who voted against the measure in Washington. In New Jersey, Republican Assemblyman George Geist today had this warning for that state's Democratic U.S. Senator Bill Bradley, who opposed the amendment.
I'm sure in 1996, when Senator Bradley pursues re-election, that this will be a significant New Jersey issue.
Geist says he sees today's vote in the U.S. Senate as a temporary setback for the balanced budget amendment, adding that even if it never does make it out of the current Congress, the vote will have been a litmus test on a crucial issue. And he predicts that after the 1996 election, Republicans will have no problem getting enough votes to send the amendment to the states. This is Don Gagne reporting.
If anyone can claim to be happy about the outcome of today's vote, it is likely to be Democratic Senator Robert Byrd. For days, he took to the floor of the Senate to denounce the balanced budget amendment, calling it an empty promise. Commentator Jack Beatty has these thoughts.
We shall not see his like again. How easily that cliche slips off the tongue. Yet it is almost certainly true about the victor in the fight over the balanced budget amendment, Robert C. Byrd, 77, of West Virginia. This is a singular man. Raised in the coal fields by an impoverished aunt and uncle after losing his mother to influenza, Byrd at first did not go to Sunday school because he had no socks to wear. He worked as a garbage collector, a gas station attendant, a welder, and a butcher. It was only after winning election to the House in 1952 that he gave up his grocery store in tiny Sophia in Raleigh County. He earned his law degree by attending night school at George Washington and American universities in Washington. It took him 10 years. Self-made, hard-made, Byrd is out of place in the millionaires' club that is the current Senate. His midnight-begotten learning is also anomalous. Byrd's detailed invocations of Roman history drew from Senator Dole the quip that C-SPAN ought to give college credit for viewers of Byrd's speeches. So it should. And not just for Roman history, but also for Shakespeare and Macaulay and Walter Savage Langdon and the Founding Fathers and, of course, the Bible. The author of a 2-volume history of the Senate, Byrd is an authority on the institution he loves and whose labyrinthine rules he is masterly at manipulating. Is there a new Robert Byrd growing up in Raleigh County? The odds are strongly against it. Money rules now in American politics, and it is a sign of the times that the other senator from West Virginia, Jay Rockefeller, carpeted his political ascent with the long green, spending something like $12 for every vote he got in his first Senate election. Byrd depends on the people who live up in the hollows, who come down to vote when he is on the ticket, and not otherwise. Famously, Byrd has used his clout to veritably pave over West Virginia with federal dollars. A balanced budget would dam that golden flow. So Byrd was not just serving the national interest in attacking the balanced budget amendment. Denouncing the amendment as a cheap, quick-fix excrescence on the sacred body of the Constitution, Byrd concluded weeks of debate by quoting the Apostle Paul. Win or lose, he said, he would go to his bed that night confident that, like Paul, he had fought the good fight. Whatever your views on the balanced budget amendment, it would be churlish to deny that.
Jack Beatty is a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. He comes to us by way of member station WBUR in Boston.
A conversation with one of the skippers in the America's Cup sailing competition, just ahead on All Things Considered. In the waters off San Diego, some quite serious sailboat racing continues on through the spring. The America's Cup Trials. The championship race comes up in May. The racing now is to choose a challenger. Seven foreign countries have sent boats, and to select a defender for the United States. Three boats are in that competition. Round four of the trials starts tomorrow. The women's team, America Cubed, is now in third place with 7 points. And tied for first at 25 points, Dennis Connor's Stars and Stripes and Young America, sailed by a syndicate called Pact 95, based in Bangor, Maine. This was a practice day in San Diego, and this morning was a good time for the skipper of Young America, Kevin Mahaney, to talk with us.
Boat's getting ready. We just launched it off a big crane. It's put in and out of the water every day, a 55,000-pound boat, and we go sailing in about a half hour.
How's the weather look?
The weather today is nice. It's different. Usually the wind always blows into the hot desert, but today it's blowing off the desert in the other direction.
Now, would each skipper of these three boats in the Defender Trials want different weather, or you're looking for the same kind of weather?
Well, it's funny, you know, you're building these boats to perform in very specific wind conditions. Some of the boats are better in the 8 or 9 knot range, some in 10, 11, and some in 12 and over. So everybody's looking for whatever favors their boat to get it the fastest around the course.
And for you?
Oh, I can't tell you that. That's one of the secrets of the America's Cup, is where exactly your design is.
Aha. Uh-huh. Proprietary information.
All proprietary information, because you're looking for strengths and weaknesses against your competitor. So if they know that you're better in one condition, they can change their boat to minimize your advantage in that condition while try to strengthening their advantage in a lighter or a heavier condition.
No. Now, I would like for you to describe, I've seen a picture of the drawing that's on the side of your boat, on the side of Young America. Can you describe that for us?
Well, we had Roy Lichtenstein. We asked him to do an impression of what it meant to him for sailing and everything, and he drew a beautiful mermaid that, after the tornado that came through our compound a couple months ago, we've nicknamed Dorothy, which is a mermaid with this flowing long hair that goes the entire length of the 75-foot boat. And it's a light blues and yellows, and it's absolutely brilliant.
Hmm. Have you seen, I'm sure you have, is it around there someplace, the new boat that's been put into the water to be sailed by the America Cube team?
I actually haven't seen the boat yet. I saw it on TV yet. It was named yesterday, Proud Mary or something like that. But, you know, the girls are going to be a lot tougher in their new boat. They've been racing a boat that's been a little bit off the pace, so I think it's going to be a lot fairer test with their new boat. It looks like it should be a fast boat.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the tornado that came through. How much damage to your boat and to your compound there did that do?
We're at about $750,000 worth of damage. The tornado was a mini tornado came through, and it picked up our sail loft, which is a little bit bigger than a basketball court, and threw it into our boat, knocked the boat off the cradle, putting holes all through the cradle, destroyed our hospitality center, and it actually took one of our sails, which weighs over 100 pounds, picked it up and deposited it at SeaWorld in the parking lot over a mile away. But being SeaWorld in the people business, they put it in the back of their truck and brought it back the next morning.
That was in January, right?
And that was in January, just a week before we started the actual racing.
Kevin, when you go out today, when you sail in one of the races on a daily basis, what is, how long does it take, and what is it like?
Well, the basic day is we're in the gym at 6:15 on the race days, work out for an hour and a half, have breakfast, the boat's in the water, and we leave the dock at 9:30. You try to get out there early to get a feel for what the wind and the weather is for that day, because it's different every day, and so the playing field changes every day. The actual races start at 12:15, so we're out there for about an hour and a half trying to choose the right sails to put up for the day and the wind conditions. The races are about 2.5-3 hours long. Come back in, we debrief, have our video, and try to get out of the compound by 8:30 that night.
Mm-hmm. A race itself can it be a very exciting thing? Can it be boring? How does it go?
Oh, the races are always exciting. You know, I've done an awful lot of races, sailed in the Olympics, and the old heart gets going every time that the warning gun goes off. We only have 5 minutes before we encounter the other boat. Because it is match racing, it's just you against one other person, so there's only one winner and one loser, so the pressure's on you every day.
But has any race been boring? Have you been so far behind in any of these, and the weather been bad that you just...
Well, we've been lucky that we've never been that far behind that it's been boring. And, you know, that's one of the great things about sailboat racing is that the weather, you know, has a lot to do with it. And you can get a really lucky shift if you're behind and get ahead. Usually a two-minute lead's hard to overcome. But in one race against the Stars and Stripes team, we were ahead by 2 minutes, then behind for 2 minutes, then we won by 2 minutes, which that race was exciting because somebody's always going by the other one. And then we had a race the other day that was only 1 second between winning and losing, and we ended up losing that one, but it was still exciting. And it was a thrill for me to watch Dennis Conner and Paul Caird, you know, some of the great sailors in the world, standing up, high-fiving each other because they beat Kevin Mahaney from Bangor, Maine.
Kevin Mahaney, skipper of the America's Cup boat, Young America.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Melinda Pencava. The House Appropriations Committee today approved more than $17 billion in spending cuts. Summer jobs programs, nutrition programs, and public broadcasting were among those whose funding would be cut back. An amendment to this package would also allow states to withhold Medicaid money for abortions. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
In the first test of abortion sentiment in the Republican-controlled 104th Congress, members of the House Appropriations Committee voted to reverse course and allow states to bar public funding for abortion for poor women who are victims of rape or incest. The measure was authored by Oklahoma Republican Ernest Istook, who said it would return authority to the states to decide whether to permit such abortions. Opponents of the measure, which included most Democrats, said it would reverse numerous court decisions and Clinton administration policy, which held that states must allow such Medicaid abortions. Opponents said just over 200 such abortions were performed last year. The measure was adopted 33-21. It's certain to be challenged in the full House when the spending cuts package goes to the floor later this month. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Senate Republicans today came up one vote short of the 67 they needed to pass the balanced budget amendment. That pleased President Clinton, who opposed the constitutional ban on deficit spending. And this afternoon, Mr. Clinton challenged Republicans in Congress to reduce the deficit without the amendment.
It has now been 57 days since the Republicans took control of the Congress. And even though their leadership has been here many, many more years, they have still not presented their budget. We passed the budget resolution for our plan before the legal deadline of April the 15th. Now they must follow that process as well.
As for the balanced budget amendment, Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole said he would bring it up for a vote during next year's congressional and presidential campaigns. The owner of the Colorado Rockies baseball team says strike negotiations, now in their fourth day in Arizona, have taken a turn for the worse and could break off today. Laura Carlson of member station KJZZ reports from Scottsdale.
Earlier this week, Colorado Rockies owner Jerry McMorris was very optimistic, predicting there could be a settlement in the nearly seven-month-old strike within a few days. But this afternoon, a clearly frustrated Rockies owner said the two sides have again reached an impasse.
We're not making any progress to getting the regular players back on the field.
Negotiators came to Arizona this week hoping a settlement could be reached, given the time pressure of the impending start of spring training games and a new feeling of goodwill. But McMorris says the two sides have failed to take advantage of what he calls a window of opportunity. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Carlson in Phoenix.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell almost 15 points today to close at 3979.93. This is NPR. In the words of one Pentagon official, U.S. Marines are off the beach in Somalia. Several hours ago, the last of the Marines boarded their amphibious vehicles and sailed away from Mogadishu. They had arrived there on Monday to protect the last of the U.N. peacekeepers who were pulling out this week. Pakistani peacekeepers left Somalia earlier today, bringing to an end the U.N.'s 27-month mission there. The Centers for Disease Control is asking that people with infectious tuberculosis refrain from taking long commercial plane flights. But overall, the CDC says the risk of getting TB on a plane is still quite low. NPR's Joe Palca has details.
The six cases all occurred in the last 3 years. In four of the cases, CDC could find no conclusive evidence that the person with TB had infected other passengers aboard the plane. But in two cases, the disease did appear to be transmitted. One involved a flight attendant who got tuberculosis and appeared to have infected other crew members, but not passengers she had traveled with. The other involved a woman who infected people sitting near her on a flight from Chicago to Honolulu. Both cases involved flights lasting longer than 8 hours. The CDC concluded that the risk of transmission of TB was no greater aboard an airplane than in any other confined space. To be on the safe side, the CDC recommends that people who know they have infectious TB should take private transportation rather than commercial aircraft. This is Joe Palca in Washington.
The space shuttle program entered cyberspace today. During the first 11 hours of the Endeavour's mission, 20,000 computer users here on Earth accessed the space shuttle on Internet's World Wide Web. The crew spent the day focusing and adjusting telescopes through which the astrophysicists will study the ultraviolet light coming from the stars and galaxies. They're hoping to find gases that could provide clues for how the universe began and also how it may end. Endeavour's 15-and-a-half-day mission would be the longest for a space shuttle. I'm Melinda Pencava, National Public Radio News, in Washington.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Republicans on Capitol Hill have changed course over who should run the food stamp program. The Contract with America called for all federal nutrition programs to be combined into smaller block grants and managed by the states. But last week, the House Agriculture Committee refused to make the government's biggest nutrition program into a block grant. After criticism from the governors, Republican leaders agreed this week to give states more control of the program. NPR's Peter Overby reports on what's at stake in the food stamp debate.
The House Committee on Economic and Educational Opportunities had no problem a week ago as it rolled the school lunch, school breakfast, school milk, and women, infants, and children programs, and several others, into just two block grants. But as the Agriculture Committee took up the $25 billion a year food stamp program, the block grant idea didn't look so good. The committee abruptly decided against turning food stamps over to the states. Chairman Pat Roberts explained that the program needed to stay in Washington because the nation needs a safety net for people who are truly needy. That explanation was met with skepticism. Since the committee's constituents include agribusinesses, food processors, and grocery chains that provide food for the 27.5 million people who get food stamps. With block grants, money now going to food stamps could be spent on anything, and the suppliers could be left with a smaller market. Peter Ferrara, a senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis, says the committee just caved in.
I don't see why people kowtow to these special interests. I mean, it's the most brazen type of thing when you're sitting here in Washington and you see these people come into a meeting where people are trying to argue over what's the best approach for the country, and they're saying, this is our money and we're going to take it and we're going to keep it. It's just I find it very disgusting to watch.
The farm and food lobbies have a big presence before the Agriculture Committee, which oversees their industry, and with Republicans in general. Take the Food Marketing Institute, the trade association for grocery chains. The Institute's Political Action Committee gave Republican candidates more than $300,000 for the 94 campaign, more than twice what it gave Democrats. And the Food Marketing Institute does not want the food stamp program to be divided into 50 state programs with 50 sets of rules. Edie Clark is the Institute's Director of Media Relations.
National uniformity is important. We have a concern about that, and we would like to see national uniformity in the application of these programs. That is traditionally the stance of our industry.
But the Agriculture Committee Republicans were picking up some unusual allies. Robert Greenstein of the Liberal Center for Budget and Policy Priorities says the committee was responding to conscience, not pressure, mindful of the fact that food stamps cushion economic downturns faster than other welfare assistance.
I've been working with this food stamp program for 20 years. I have yet to see great work on its behalf by the farm interests. This is largely, not entirely, but largely a myth. I think what went on here is that those Republican members and their staffs worked diligently for a couple of months trying to figure out how to do a block grant, and they came up against the reality.
That reality, according to Greenstein, is that as block grants, food stamp programs would not have the flexibility or the money to help in hard times. But the committee ran into another reality this week as Republican governors lobbied the House GOP leadership to change the committee's proposal. The governors wanted control of food stamps, and so the House leadership agreed to a compromise. States will be able to set up food stamp programs that use electronic debit cards. That means money from the food stamp program won't be going into a block grant, and the food industry would have a better chance to keep its markets intact. This week's flip-flops on food stamps make some conservatives nervous. Peter Ferrara of the National Center for Policy Analysis says the episode does not bode well for Republicans who promised to change the way Washington works.
I think the Republicans have to take a firm stand early on and let these special interest groups know that they are not going to cave into them. And if you cave in the first time here, then you're going to, the other groups are going to come in and they're going to have a stronger case to demand that you cave into them too. Because if you caved into these agriculture interests, why can't you cave into everyone all the way down the pike?
The food stamp bill is not the biggest item on the Agriculture Committee's agenda. Later on, the panel must deal with one of the biggest entitlement programs of all, farm subsidies. This is Peter Overby in Washington.
The National Endowment for the Humanities came under congressional scrutiny during hearings this week. The NEH had managed to avoid the spotlight during the opening months of the 104th Congress. But in testimony this week, NEH Chairman Sheldon Hackney defended his agency in the face of proposed budget cuts. NPR's Tom Cole reports.
Today's Senate hearing opened with Hackney describing his efforts to streamline the NEH to make it more cost-efficient. But he was asked what he would do if federal funds were eliminated. Could the private sector make up the difference?
I cannot think of any way that it would be possible to raise the amount of money that is necessary. And it's quite clear that the corporate and private philanthropic community cannot provide the funds for the humanities. They do not now. All of their dollars are fully deployed. I can't imagine why they would redeploy those dollars in dramatic ways just because we did not exist. So I think privatization is a very difficult road to go down.
Private funders were represented at the hearing by Dr. Alberta Arthurs of the Ford Foundation. She said that foundations give about $50 million a year to the humanities, compared with the more than $170 million the NEH provides.
Privatization usually means, as it's commonly used, that there will be investors and managers standing by ready to take on whatever institution it is that's about to be privatized. I can't find those people standing by ready to take on the endowment. They're simply not there. And there also is not an agency, a home, a place for this to go. So I don't understand, frankly, the notion of privatization in this case. I don't think the endowment can exist without the support of the federal government, nor do I think it should, frankly. It's a national resource.
The endowment received its strongest criticism from Dr. Walter Burns, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He told senators that just as the NEA depends on the arts world to define the arts, the NEH depends on the academic world to define the humanities. And Dr. Burns says America's university professors are too concerned with political correctness.
Scholarship has become politicized. Scholars are supposed to be committed not to the truth or to the facts, but committed to a political cause. What can you do about it? Absolutely nothing. It would be improper for the Senate of the United States to attempt to reform what's going on in the universities. But you can do one thing. You can refuse to fund them. Thank you.
Some of the senators criticized NEH funding of national standards for the teaching of history, saying they smack of historical revisionism. The History Standards Project began under Sheldon Hackney's predecessor, Republican Lynn Cheney, who has become one of the endowment's harshest critics. Hackney told the senators he was trying to address some of their concerns.
While I think that I ought not to, just as a matter of principle, ought not to be dictating what those standards are, I have quietly encouraged the director of that project to come together with his critics and to try to accommodate them.
In general, the senators seemed inclined to support the continued existence of the National Endowment for the Humanities, though they indicated it will face budget cuts. I'm Tom Cole in Washington.
A couple of complaints to begin with in our mailbag. From Greenville, South Carolina, Gordon Sharon writes, a reporter named Susanna Capiluto in Atlanta used the phrase, last year's failed healthcare debate. What arrogance! What preconceived ideas! Most people thought the healthcare debate was very successful in stopping the attempted socialization of the American healthcare system.
Our interview with Audrey James, convicted of espionage, brought this from Walter Vogel of Akron, Ohio. The man is a conscious murderer and traitor. The effect of this interview is to dilute the inexpiable crimes of which he is guilty. It was disgusting and obscene, and I turned the radio off.
And a couple of thank yous as well. Your story on Michael Ramsey, the young man who ran into a burning building to save a woman from death, was inspiring and distracted me from my usual preoccupation with genocide in Bosnia. The controversy over this young man's marijuana use is outrageous hypocrisy, to say the least.
That is from Dee Dee Fowler of Washington, D.C. And Jenny Westmoreland of St. Louis writes, thank you very much for paying tribute to the late Mel Franklin, a founding member of the Temptations. His passing is touching indeed, because now four of the original five Temptations are gone. Perhaps I attribute too much to their tremendous harmonies, rhythms, and string of number one hits, but I believe the Temptations were responsible for many of us middle-class, suburban white kids in the 1960s ultimately embracing the civil rights movement. Also, is there one baby boomer around today who hasn't at least closed his or her eyes, held someone close, and danced to My Girl?
And many letters about greyhounds, including this note from Dan and Jerry Skowski of Marietta, Georgia. My wife and I were disturbed by Alyssa Eli's essay about her experiences adopting and then returning Elmer, the former racing greyhound. We have adopted two greyhounds, and we volunteer at an adoption center, which has matched hundreds of lucky greyhounds and owners since 1992. Like Elmer, some greyhounds do arrive from the track abused, maladjusted, or extremely timid, and require extraordinary effort. However, the majority of adoptions are much less traumatic. Everything is a new experience. It may take months for a newly adopted greyhound to begin to play and develop a new personality. Unfortunately, Ms. Eli missed this experience, and so did your listeners.
Thanks to all for writing or sending along email. Our addresses are Letters, All Things Considered, National Public Radio, 635 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001, or atc@npr.org. By either method, please send along a daytime phone number. The basics of photography have not changed very much over the years. An image is captured on light-sensitive film. The film is placed in chemical developers, and a negative of the image is created. Only then can a positive image, a photograph, be produced by taking the negative and placing it over specially processed paper and exposing both to light. But the arrival of digital photography is shaking things up. NPR's John McChesney has this report on the technology that's making it possible to create a virtual darkroom with a personal computer.
Amateur photography can mean spending hours in the darkroom, bent over trays of developer and fixer, then filling the kitchen sink with prints which have to be washed for hours. Or, if you're working with color slides, you have to measure and mix chemicals you just know aren't good for you, and then monitor temperatures with headache-producing accuracy. And you can get bleary-eyed working with an enlargement, trying to adjust the contrast exactly the way you want it, burning in underexposed areas, holding light back from overexposed areas. Jonathan Sachs is the president of Digital Light and Color. He makes software called Picture Window for processing photographs in a personal computer.
One of the big motivations I had was that as an amateur photographer, I found photography really frustrating because I'd spend a lot of time and money on camera equipment and going out to locations, and frequently I was really unhappy with the prints I would get back. And when I started working with my photographs on the computer, I discovered that I wasn't that bad a photographer. I just didn't have as much control as I needed over the printing process.
Now, digital photography is moving into an affordable price range for amateurs. This is especially good news for people who don't have the space or the money for a darkroom.
When you're working at home, you know, there's no smell, it's clean, you can work for a few minutes at a time, or you can work for a long stretch. And if you get interrupted, you can just stop what you're doing and pick up right where you left off.
In order to work with your photographs on a computer, you first have to get the pictures into the computer, and then you have to get them out. In other words, print them. Bill Krause is the president of Storm, a company making new software called Easy Photo. He says there are three ways to get your pictures into your computer.
The first way is by floppy, and that's still probably one of the most popular ways to get photographs into the computer. The second way is through Photo CD, Kodak Photo CD. The third way is through external peripherals, like a digital camera, or through new kinds of photo input devices, one of which we're introducing called the Easy Photo Reader.
The only way you can get pictures into a computer without having the film developed by someone else is by using a digital camera, and we'll come back to those cameras in a minute. But if you use a conventional camera, the photo CD process is probably the best way. When you take your film in to be developed, for an extra fee, the film lab will put the images on a CD for you, and then you can get them into your computer using the CD-ROM drive. The other way, as Bill Krause points out, is to use what's called a scanner, a device that works a little bit like a copy machine, and until recently cost almost as much as a copy machine. Krause has set out to change that. He makes a little scanner that will take up to 4x6 prints and costs only $250. You can use the scanner to enter photos you took years ago, or old family photos that you want to clean up. And Krause's software makes it possible for you to paste your photos into letters composed on popular word processors like WordPerfect and Microsoft Word. He shows off a letter he wrote that included several pictures of his family.
I get a big kick out of this. Is actually the holiday letter that I created this past Christmas. I sent it out to about 100 of my very closest friends and relatives. And, you know, this would be a document that I created in my word processor. And all I did is I created first the words, and then I selected the photographs that the words described, and then I dragged and dropped the photographs right into my word processor. And there, you know, here they are, actually completely word wrapped and positioned and placed and ready to be printed out.
With photo CDs, it's been possible to get pictures into your computer for quite a while. But until recently, it's been too expensive to own a printer that would reproduce them. Professional color printers are still very high priced. Kodak's basic machine costs around $10,000. But today's inkjet printers will do what's called near photographic quality. Both Hewlett-Packard and Epson make machines that sell for around $500, and on special paper, the higher-resolution Epson machine will turn out work that at first glance looks like a real photograph. Look closely, though, and you'll see the grainy dots of digital output. But what's most fun about desktop photography is the ways in which you can manipulate your photograph. You can crop and resize your picture. You can change contrast and color tones. And the editing process is non-destructive, so if you make a mistake, you just undo it. Low-end software like Easy Photo allows you to remove scratches from old photos. And mid-level software like Digital Light and Color's Picture Window permits even more sophisticated processing. Again, Jonathan Sachs.
There's a process called cloning, which lets you basically graft one piece of the image over another. So to remove a freckle, you can just take a little piece of the adjacent skin and paste it right over the freckle, and you don't have to worry about knowing how to mix colors or getting the texture right. It'll just automatically match perfectly.
So far, everything we've described depends on conventional film, with negatives or slides usually being processed by someone else. Then you do the printing in your computer. But you could use a digital camera that records images directly onto a disc, which can be loaded straight into your computer, a chemical-free process. Digital cameras are still very expensive, ranging from a low of $700 for Apple's QuickTake to a high of $28,000 for Kodak's top-end machine. The principal advantage of a digital camera is its speed. From shutter click to finished image is just a matter of seconds or minutes. Paul Lawton works for Logitech, a company making a small camera that will take 48 pictures.
This makes it much, much easier to get a real-world image directly into a computer document. And for those people that need to do that, for example, real estate appraisers, this camera can be a godsend. It can save them many thousands of dollars a year in film and processing. It also saves them a great deal of time.
But the pictures have fuzzy resolution. To get anything approaching what conventional film will do, you'll have to pay a minimum of $9,000, and the resolution still won't equal conventional silver halide film, a medium that will no doubt be around for a long time. But manipulation and printing of pictures, after the film has been developed, is moving out of the darkroom and into a clean, well-lighted place, the desktop computer. In San Francisco, I'm John McChesney.
Sometimes a good idea and the right technology just click. Jim Metzner has been learning about Japanese history with a new CD-ROM.
One of the things that the CD-ROM medium lends itself to is the exploration of a virtual landscape. By clicking a mouse button or depressing a key, you have the illusion of moving through a 3D environment, often interacting with objects or life forms by clicking on them. Well, now imagine yourself navigating through the streets of Kyoto, Japan, 1,000 years ago. But the world you move through seems to have as many ghosts and demons in it as there are people. The Cosmology of Kyoto, one of the best CD-ROMs I've seen in a long time, takes you on a journey through the historical and supernatural worlds of Imperial Kyoto. On your journey, although the streets initially seem deserted, you're soon confronted by a samurai warrior who asks for a magic amulet that you'd found on the ground only a few moments before. The dialogue is spoken in Japanese with English subtitles. You reply via the keyboard. A few moments later, you pass by a marketplace where they wager on a cockfight. A chance encounter with a courtesan turns scary when a demon drops by at just the wrong moment. A Buddhist monk invites you into a temple where you participate in the worship. Out in the streets again, you run into another demon, make the wrong move, and boom, you're dead, virtually speaking, and you're relegated to one of the levels of Buddhist hell, which level depends upon your karma status at the moment of your demise in your virtual existence. I ended up in the hell of black chains, witnessing a lot of my fellow residents getting eviscerated by grinning demons. Guess I shouldn't have messed around with a courtesan. Now, at any point in the Cosmology of Kyoto, you can dip into their extensive reference section and find out what the historical or mythological occurrences were which relate to the current scenario. It turns out that the entire CD was meticulously researched by scholars at Osaka University. The aim is to entertain, but if you want to learn about the cultural history of Japan, I couldn't think of a better introduction.
Our reviewer is Jim Metzner. The CD-ROM is called The Cosmology of Kyoto.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate has failed to pass the balanced budget amendment. Supporters were one vote short of the 67 votes needed to pass the measure. They say they'll use the issue against Democrats in the next election. Democrats say it's now time to do the actual work of balancing the budget. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The vote came as no surprise, although there was tension on both sides. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle said the outcome was up to Republicans. The amendment would pass with 70 votes, he said, if only supporters would agree to protect the Social Security Trust Fund. But regardless of the outcome, he said Congress should get on with balancing the budget. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole shrugged off the Social Security argument as politics pure and simple. And he appealed to senators to at least vote to give the issue to the states, where the amendment would go next for ratification if it had passed.
I'm willing to trust the American people to make the right decision. Those who oppose the amendment or not, that's what this debate's all about.
Dole has already threatened to use the issue against Democrats in the next election. Daschle responded angrily today, saying, "Let him try, let him try." I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Officials of the Five Nation Contact Group on Bosnia are reportedly unimpressed with a counter-proposal offered by Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic. The Reuters news agency quoted an anonymous U.S. official as saying that Milosevic is not offering any significant concessions in return for the lifting of U.N. economic sanctions. The contact group wants Serbia to formally recognize the governments of Croatia and Bosnia, where ethnic Serbian rebels have seized territory. The contact group is composed of the United States, Russia, France, Germany, and Britain. The House began work today on the last of a trio of bills meant to drastically rein in the way federal agencies make rules and regulations. NPR's Philip Davis has this report.
This is the final and most controversial of the anti-regulation proposals in the Republican Contract with America. It would compensate property owners if a federal wetlands or endangered species rule reduced the value of a person's property by as little as 10%. Supporters came armed with horror stories of property owners who lost the use of their land because of unyielding government regulations. They said the law, if passed, would make regulators think twice before writing rules that affect property owners. But its opponents said that the bill would, in reality, create a huge new government entitlement program and could easily be abused by speculators. Though supported by House Republican leaders, more than a dozen Republicans signed a letter last week expressing reservations about the bill. The House is scheduled to vote on the measure Friday. This is Philip Davis reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 15 points to close at 3,980 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The last U.S. Marines have left Somalia after protecting the withdrawal of United Nations peacekeeping troops. Witnesses said that shots and explosions were heard at the Mogadishu harbor after the Marines left. Somali militiamen loyal to General Mohamed Farah Aidid reportedly fired some of the shots as they moved to seize control of the city's harbor and airport. Yesterday, a U.S. Marine shot and killed a Somali who fired a rocket-propelled grenade toward American lines. There was no report of the extent of any casualties from today's shooting, although U.S. officials say no Marines were hurt. The withdrawal ends a two-year U.N. intervention in Somalia that brought famine relief but not peace to the East African nation. AIDS activists won a small victory in Congress today but lost another battle. Republicans defeated an amendment that would have restored a federal program that provides housing for people with AIDS. NPR's Vicky Quay reports.
The House Appropriations Committee voted 37-18 to restore $36 million in cuts for AIDS prevention and treatment, including the Ryan White CARE Act. But Republicans on the committee rejected another amendment from Ohio Democrat Lewis Stokes, who sought to restore more than $2 billion in cuts for public housing. $100 million of that would have paid for housing vouchers for people with AIDS. The program was created in 1990 because studies show as many as half the people with HIV become homeless at some point. Republicans say the program isn't needed because people with AIDS are eligible for housing under other government programs. But activists say waiting lists for public housing in many cities are so long that people sick with AIDS are likely to die before public housing for them becomes available. I'm Vicky Quay in Washington.
Americans' personal income rose more than twice as fast as spending in January, the biggest gain in 3 months. The Commerce Department said that personal incomes grew by 0.9%. This is NPR News.